I'm delighted to be here tonight in the cozy confines of Artifact Coffee to continue our Origin Speaker Series. I'm Spike Jurta, the owner of Woodbury Kitchen here in Baltimore. This gathering is intended to advance the conversation about food, its origins, and what is happening around our food system in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. We started our first restaurant, Woodbury Kitchen, with a commitment to local sourcing, and now work closely with more than 60 different farmers and producers throughout the region. We supply our four restaurants and our canning and butchery operations with meat, eggs, grains, fish and shellfish, cooking oil, cheeses and produce, literally everything we need to feed our guests. The hope is that this series will shine a light on the work that this community is doing in our area. The conversation is held monthly at Artifact, our coffee shop, in the heart of the Woodbury neighborhood in Baltimore.
All right. Welcome. It's great to be back for our first installment this fall. Welcome back. I think three quarters of you have been to Origins before. Who's new? Anybody new here? New? Got, okay, that's good. All right, so I'll talk a little bit about what we do here a little later on, but welcome back. Tonight, we're actually introducing a two-parter. It's the first time we've ever done this. We'll see how it goes.
Bold new direction.
So you have to remember everything from tonight and then bring it forward with you 1 week from tonight, because we're going to be talking about sort of the economics of the local food movement and how that sort of the impact of it, and we're going to just take a deep dive. I just wanted to say that, like, the whole idea behind Origins when we started it was to highlight the farmers, the fishermen, the producers, and the makers behind the whole local food movement.
We did all that, so.
And so, so we've done all that, so now it's time.
Really, it's so true.
So I just wanted to say Spike started Woodbury Kitchen 10 years ago. With a commitment to local growers and producers, and his team deserves great kudos for generating over $2.1 million annually back into the local economy. Is that an accurate number?
Sounds about right.
Okay. I think that deserves a lot of kudos. So I just, with that kind of idea, we said we've never really looked at it from all different sides. So for tonight, we're looking at it from both the retail perspective and through the lens of an Eastern Shore aggregator called Chesapeake Harvest, based in Easton. So a week from tonight, and we have a deal, if you want to come back next week, we'll continue the conversation from with two local farmers, Dave Liker from Gorman Farms and Mark Toigo from Toigo Orchards. So Mark sells to Whole Foods and about 10 other farmers markets, so I think he has a great perspective on this, building multiple sales channels. Dave's sales channels is exclusively CSAs, so we'll learn a little bit about how that works as well. So for any of you that are interested in attending next week, for our loyal Origins attendees, just for tonight, you can get a ticket for $50. So if you want a ticket, see Lauren Jones. But tonight, we're thrilled to welcome Scott Nash and Tracy Ward. And here's a brief bio on both of them. So Tracy, obviously over here, has over 30 years of experience as an economic and community development leader, devoting her career to community transformation and change through collaborative public-private partnership and cross-disciplinary strategies. In 2004, Tracy founded Urbanite, which I'm sorry to say I was sad to see it go, an award-winning glossy magazine with a circulation of over 60,000 in the Baltimore metropolitan area. After shuttering Urbanite in 2012, Tracy took a year off to work on farms and learn about our local food system. In 2014, as executive director of the Easton Economic Corporation, Tracy started Chesapeake Harvest, a sales, marketing, and branding organization committed to increasing sales of locally and sustainably grown food products in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. That's a mouthful. So welcome, Tracy. So I'm going to hold this up. So for those of you who shop there, you'll know this. I looked at this and I said, you got to love a guy that puts his personal email on every grocery bag. And I actually tried it, and it worked.
Oh, nice.
Is that how we got them here?
That's how.
All right.
So I have a lot of these, by the way. I'm really glad you came to Baltimore County. So Scott Nash started Mom's Organic Market at the age of 22 with an initial investment of $100 as a home delivery business out of his mom's garage. And in July 1987, Mom's made its first sale delivering to a customer who lived in Rockville, Maryland. Since then, Mom's has grown to become one of the nation's premier chains of family-owned and operated organic grocery stores. Mom's has 19 stores in D.C., Maryland, New Jersey, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. Mom's purpose is to protect and restore the environment, and Mom's also takes on issues such as banning advertising to children and raising the minimum wage, and this guy drives a Tesla.
And a Volt.
And a Volt, right. And you can charge in his parking lot. Yeah. That I know, too. So last but not least, as oiled, it's a well-oiled machine that behind the Origins programs, and I'd like to thank everybody that sort of got us here to this point, which includes Spike, obviously, Hannah Reagan in the back, Lauren Paven-Jones, and her hardworking staff here at Artifact Coffee. Thank you to Mary Romeo for our Facebook posts, Donnie Carlo for recording and engineering the program, and Grace Gillespie for arranging tonight's flowers. And tonight's chefs are Pat and Chef Leo. Mm-hmm. Do I have that right? And Spike will tell us a little bit more about our meal at the end of the conversation. So for those of you that are new, we record the proceedings, and then the program is edited and put into a podcast format and uploaded to Heritage Public Radio in Brooklyn, New York. So all of our past productions from the last 3 years are all located there if you want to go back and geek out on 25 prior origins. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Spike.
Thanks, Dana. I'm really so excited for this conversation, and I'm going to try to do my best to kind of weave these incredibly important threads of our food system together. And I've already expressed personally my thanks to our two guests for making the relatively long trip to the friendly confines of Artifact Coffee here in Baltimore, Maryland. Our closest neighborhood is Hamden, and Scott just let me know that the Hamden Moms is most weeks the number one Moms, which I just think that's we can start. I don't know why that makes me so happy. It makes me so proud. But I have to start off and just say that I am an unabashed fan of Moms. If I go to a supermarket, it's Moms. My son has a fixation on the hot food bar at Whole Foods, which I try to look the other way on. But for me, if I'm shopping in a store for food, it's going to be Moms. There are a couple reasons for that. I think it's the only store that does a good job with the things that I want to buy. It's still, as Dana mentioned, it's family owned and operated. It has a real connection to this place, and I shouldn't let it go unsaid that they also stock canny or Woodbury Pantry jams and jellies and snake oil and tomatoes. So I'm grateful for that as well. But it's a great shopping experience, and I'm going to start with Scott, and Dana did a nice job of kind of providing some background. But one of the things that always struck me about Moms, and one of the things that resonated with me right away, is the fact that, you know, right up front you talk about it as an environmental. One of the big reasons that I think that you did this, and one of your, I think, missions is an environmental one. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I was born. It was a coincidence that I got into organic foods. I was raised by progressives out of Minnesota, and I have a cousin who I've only met like twice. She started Little Bear Organics or Burritos out on the West Coast. Completely, I had actually forgotten she'd done that after I started my company. So it's kind of in our family's heritage or values to be into the environmental movements. And so I'm lucky in that organic farming and the food and the products that we sell is great for the environment in that it is obviously missing, you know, tonnage of really nasty toxins, which destroy some environments, and they stress every environment, basically. And we thought to ourselves, well, let's double down on this. It's my passion. It's most of our employees' passions. And really be as environmental as a operation as we could be. And we feel like we are the most environmental company our size, for sure, grocery, in the world, maybe. I mean, we just do so much. Everything that we can, basically, that's feasible.
So one of the things that occurs to me is that when you get into retailing food, mm-hmm. and we made a little bit of light of it earlier, saying that we've covered the makers and the farmers but this is really a crucial part of our food system and the one that most of us have the most contact with. You know, most of us aren't going to visit a farm or go see a beekeeper on a daily basis, but many, many of us will go to a retail food store of some kind, a supermarket, a grocery, and buy their food. And when you do that, the business side of that is that these are some of the biggest companies in the world. And so mm-hmm. you open in 1987, is that right? Which is amazing to me. And you probably don't realize at the time that you're going to kind of wade into these waters where you're going to go up against gigantic corporations like mm-hmm. Kroger and Walmart. Mm-hmm. But here you are now, all these years later. And this is a hyper-competitive part of the food mm-hmm. system that we talk about. What is that? I'm just like... It's amazing to me on some level that you can compete against these behemoths.
Yeah, I might be the most amazed. I mean, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, and it's a good thing I started small because I didn't have much to lose, and I learned as I went. I mean, it took me for us 9 years for me to get to $1 million in annual revenues. That's incredibly slow growth. Even though it was about 20% a year, starting from the our first sale, and we're substantially larger than that now. I'll put this out there. I think that one day, before I die, we'll be a $1 billion company. I had to learn as I went. I read a lot of books, figured it out as I went. That's all I can say. I'm passionate. I will say this about grocery. I kind of feel like it's an easy, and retail in general, it's easy to compete because the managers at grocery operations and those executives and retail tend to be set in their ways with how they manage. They're outdated. They are all white men, basically. They have a kind of a militant way of I'm the boss, I know what's best. They have quite a bit of hubris, and so you've seen some disruptors into the grocery industry come in and devastate the Giants and the Safeways of the world, and they have gotten squeezed hard, and they deserve to get squeezed hard. It's kind of like our auto industry here, where they came out from Tesla and the Japanese, and they were just almost archaic in their thinking. And so anyway, that's how I see grocery. And you have Whole Foods, who has come in and laid waste to the landscape. And then you have Aldi's and Trader Joe's and these even Walmart with these discounters. And these guys were left with their hat in hand and didn't know what hit them. And we were one of the disruptors, obviously not to any close to the level of scale as a Whole Foods or Trader Joe's, for example. But we are... some innovators who helped to disrupt the industry over the last 20 years.
It's when you think about grocery stores, it's interesting to me that it's a wholly American invention in a way. And a lot of the things, a lot of the components of the grocery store experience, the checkout aisle, the fact that you it seems ridiculous now, but the fact that you take the product off the shelf yourself and put it in your cart as opposed to somebody doing that. All of these were innovations, really, in the early 1900s, innovations, I guess, in some sense, that kind of add up now to the grocery or supermarket experience that we all kind of expect. You're talking about your place in this kind of long tradition, this history as a disruptor, and your disruption is organic? Is that how you think of it?
No, kind of. I mean, our model is a different model. I think Trader Joe's has a similar model. I will tell you, as a grocer, when I look at operations and the brands they built and their execution, I feel like the two greatest grocery operations were Trader Joe's and Costco. You know, when they were launched, if you were Costco and said we're going to have this huge store, it costs $40 a shop here. Whatever you buy, you have to buy a lot of it. Would you like to invest? I think they would have been laughed out of the. And they're incredible. Trader Joe's, our produce sucks. We have 3,000 items. Some of the stuff we have one ketchup. You know, there's no variety. What's there one week isn't there the next week. People would have thought you're nuts. And they have a higher sales per foot than any chain in the world for their size. So I feel like we are.
Do you understand what is the? Can you quantify or describe what the appeal of Trader Joe's is to someone that hates Trader Joe's?
Well, I mean, first of all, they have a very strong and disciplined brand. With even their, you know, every Trader Joe's store has a full time sign maker. Everything's handwritten. They want every store to be different. There's a treasure hunt aspect. There are products that they have that no other company has, whether it's like a cilantro shrimp frozen deal or their speculoos cookie ice cream. You know, so they've done very well at what's called treasure hunt and their brand. And there is a lot of science out there that talks about how there's a great book called The Art of Choice or Choosing that talks about how too much choice is actually bad for most people. That's why Trader Joe says, this is the ketchup, we've tested it, and this is the one you're going to buy from us, and that's it. We, on the other hand, have a lot of ketchups because our customers are they're high-level experts, they're very educated, and they want a fruit juice sweetened ketchup. They want a local ketchup. They want a, you know...
They want a local ketchup?
A honey ketchup, yeah.
Are we taking notes here?
Yeah. So anyway, they... the door's been blown open on the grocery industry. Really, mainly, I feel like starting with Whole Foods and Trader Joe's on that, and then the discounters like Aldi and even the dollar stores on the low end.
So let's change it up. I want to switch over to Tracy for a second, and I'd like to start, I guess, with a different history, which is the history of produce growing on the Eastern Shore, where you're doing your work. And I think that to me would be a great place to start because a lot of what was there isn't there anymore, but you seem to be tapping into the tremendous potential that still exists in that part of our state.
Right. So actually, the Eastern Shore was the tomato capital of the world back in, I guess it would be like the 50s. We had canning operations all over the Eastern Shore. The packing house in Cambridge was owned by the Phillips Packing House, and they shipped packed tomatoes all over the world. At some point, that started to shift right after the 50s, where the infrastructure investments weren't made. We started to see cheap labor out of Mexico coming up into California, and irrigation was needed in order to sustain the industry, and those infrastructure improvements weren't really made. So everything started to shift to California. And as that happened, the farms consolidated and started to turn over to other products. Like today, of course, we know it's all pretty much 99% chickens or corn and soy in order to feed the chickens. And so it's industrialized. It's a commodities market. And the small farms, we did have small farms and truck farming as well. They would come into the cities. They also went away. So all that infrastructure that supported that pretty much dried up. But on the plus side, we have 1.5 million acres in the Delmarva Peninsula. It's the largest growing area on the eastern seaboard. And so we have a tremendous potential to tap into some of the concerns that are legitimate concerns about our food security in order to foster more growing local so that we can basically meet the demands of our local market. There's 42 million people that live within a day's drive of Easton, Maryland. So Easton, in a lot of ways, is sort of in the center of this. And so even we sort of have big aspirations for the future of our Eastern Shore and our 1.5 million acres. But it's sort of like turning a ship around in a very small harbor, because it's a predominantly industrialized economy over there. And so getting sort of the farming community to even embrace the idea of growing products that we actually eat, produce, fruits, whatever, it's a challenge for them. On the flip side, what's helping us right now is the market for corn and soy and chickens is very much, I don't want to say endangered, but there are definitely concerns about the viability of the market. As consumer preferences for organic, for example, are coming more and more online. But other things as well, as we're seeing what's going on with the tariffs, we're seeing what's going on in the global marketplace. There's been a lot of opening up with trade with China. So our farmers actually are not in a very secure position. And then you layer in a whole lot of other factors that are sort of global and national. And you find that the farms they realize they do need to diversify, and perhaps tapping into the local economy through food would be the way to do that. Specialty crops is what we call vegetables and fruits. They're actually called specialty crops. Only 1% of what we grow is specialty. 99% of what we grow is for animal.
In our state.
In our pretty much nationwide. And by the way, I do have resources here, some really excellent resources that my staff and I put together where you can really read up and get great information on this stuff.
Is part of the mission at Chesapeake Harvest to, is it also environmental based? I mean,
yes.
I think it's pretty well understood that commodity farming has a detrimental effect on the Chesapeake Bay, for example. Is that part of your mission?
So, yeah, absolutely. So it is our notion that the consumer preference is to have cleaner food. So get away. Obviously, the organic is number one way to do that, to be assured that your food is relatively clean. Knowing your farmer, knowing their practices is another. Our goal is to do that for you. So what we do is we're on the farms every day. We're working closely with the farmers. We understand their growing practices. And we're educating them about your preferences. And the Eastern Shore is a very interesting place. A lot of people say it's like stepping back in time. I would say that it probably is like stepping back in time. You go over there, and it feels like it's 50 years behind. And so a lot of the farming community does not even, when we started this 4 years ago, they did not even understand the demand. They did not, farm to table wasn't happening in Easton, except for maybe one restaurant here and one somewhere else. We've seen that change quite a bit just in the last, let's say, 4 years. But back to Spike's question about the environment, our goal is to work with the farms, understand their practices, and then to begin to train them and educate them on how they can modify their practices for consumer preference, for the cleaner food, that ultimately will bring a higher value in the marketplace. The key here is to get you to pay more for your food. I mean, at the end of the day, we're externalizing our costs through environmental, through our health, by making poor choices. And those choices are very much structural in terms of our government and some of the policies that we have. And so to change these things, you have to really get in the trenches and work with the farmers shoulder to shoulder, because they can't turn on a dime. They have to make a living. And so how do you do that? So you help them along the path. And creating a brand called Chesapeake Harvest is one way that we want to differentiate our products coming out of the Eastern Shore, actually out of the watershed, so much greater footprint eventually, is how we're going to do that, through standards for our growers.
Do you have any growers that are organic, certified organic?
Or we do. We do absolutely have growers that are organic. What I would say is that still not enough. The economics are just not really supportive. Mm-hmm. In the local marketplace, I think the marketplace that Scott's working in, where you're selling at a large scale, big volume, out in California, those folks have different machinery, different technology, different everything, even a different support system than we have here in Maryland or on the Eastern Shore.
I'm going to ask that question, I guess, in a different way to Scott. You start out. Did you name it? Was it Moms from the get go? Was it?
No, it was very catchy. Organic Foods Express.
And then it became Moms.
It was a very random. That wasn't even my idea to name it Moms. But it was called Organic Foods Express because I started it in my mom's garage doing home delivery in the middle of the night. And then it's a long story, but I also started doing
it. How appreciative was that you got the home delivery thing before any of these?
Let me tell you, I feel like to this day I'm almost retired because home delivery was so freaking hard back in the day. I mean, I pulled 40-hour work days. It was really, really difficult. So as it, like Spike said, like now they come and they get it and they give you the money right away. You know, you have to deliver it.
But now it is my organic market. Is that?
No, it's Moms now.
It's just Moms.
It was Organic Foods Express, then it was my organic market, but our logo was M Apple Lamb, so people started calling us Moms. And then one time we were at a strategic planning thing and we wrote different names of the company up on the top of the page, and that was a problem.
What is this company called?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
So we had to change it to Moms Organic Market.
Okay. And which is good, because the question I want to ask you is, how do you feel about tying kind of your wagon to this word organic, which is now, you know, there's a lot of questions about what it means, about the certification itself. I get it, but we have growers that I talk to that say, I don't do that because it's, you know, the certification doesn't mean anything, or it's, you know, it's...
If the organic certification doesn't mean anything, then what certification does? Like it is the most certified food we have available to us. Wherever there's humans involved, there's going to be error and even fraud. But it is the most stringent and the most controlled. There's on-site inspections. There are lab testing. It's the most trustworthy certification you can get. I think they're just kind of not into organics, the ones who say it's cost prohibitive. And they're just using that more as an excuse. What was your question? Was there another one?
It's part of your name is the word organic.
Okay, so I'm very proud to sell organic foods. I actually, people romanticize farmers. I don't. They are responsible for more pollution and wreak more environmental havoc than many industries. The organic farmers I love. I mean, they are heroes to me. But I'm not a big fan of the Farm Bureau, whatever it is. You alluded to systems set up that are actually not favorable to organic. There's so many farm subsidies, which is pretty much corporate welfare for these gargantuan agro businesses, and the organic farm doesn't get that. They are left out of that. They have some insurance, but it just isn't as much nearly. And so I was on the Organic Trade Association board for many years. Our biggest goal was to just please let us have an equal play field and get equal subsidies, and that hasn't happened. So I'm not a fan of the chemical farming industry or farmers who do it.
And I mean, one of the other thing that we're kind of facing is that there is this perception, and I guess it's backed up, that organic is growing. Is that the case?
Well, I'm so lucky to be in this industry. I mean, I latched on to it in 1987. And the industry has grown double digits for 30 years. I've been in business for 31 years, and it's double digits. It's been very easy. So demand has always outstripped supply, and it still is. I think we're up to 5% of all sales now. And, when I got in, it was like a third of 1% or something. It was nothing. So it is growing, and it's not going to stop. The way I see it, it's not just like a trendy fad like kale might be. It's really, it's like a trendy fad like civil rights are. Like it's right. It's the right direction. It's good for humanity. You very eloquently described it as profits are privatized, and the real costs are made public. The problems are you know, dished off to the public, whether it's health or environmental destruction. So it's going in the right direction. It hasn't stopped, and it's not going to stop, I don't think.
Is there a specific way that you see, having done this for as long as you have, that local sourcing fits in to what you do at Moms?
Local sourcing, Spike, you and I have talked about this.
Yeah. I didn't say I wouldn't ask you.
I'll go on the record to say that I think that the local food movement is a little overrated. First of all, you know, I have a friend who wrote a book on local economies, and he and I argued about it quite a few years ago. And I said, are you telling me that the Washington, D.C. area, which is propped up by $5 billion in federal contracting, needs local economic support? Like, I actually like that, for example, people are people no matter where they are. So the economic part of it, I think people in rural areas, you know, let's say Walmart, it opened in Bentonville, you know, they built a whole community there, and there probably wasn't much there beforehand, and now
they have an airport.
Right, and so, you know, their local community was made very strong by Walmart. Long story short is people are people no matter where they live. I don't think our economy needs support from that point of view. I think local stuff is fantastic when it's fantastic. If it's higher quality, it's great. It's obviously going to be fresher if it's closer. Mm-hmm. But my experience is that organic farms that are large for a reason, because the people running those companies are smart, they're innovative, they're efficient, and they, for example, Driscoll strawberries grow in California. That's where strawberries meant to be grown, and that's why they're less perishable. They taste, you know, all that. So it's never all things are equal. All things are equal, local is good, but it's never all things are equal.
Will you guys take local strawberries in the season? Like in May, like moment in May where it's...
You know, we do, and then I always gripe about it because the bottom of the thing is seeping with red juice, and because they don't have the proper cooling systems, they're delivering them down in trucks that aren't even refrigerated. They're picking them at 11 o'clock in the morning on a hot day. They're not water cooled. You know, organic strawberry is delicious. It's fantastic. I love you, farmer, for growing it. But the bottom line is, you're getting half the strawberry, and in other words, it's twice the price, honest to God, of like a Driscoll, even when they're in season here. And they're only going to last for a couple of days if you're lucky.
So can I flip that to you and ask you, local food economy overrated?
I would say not. I mean, absolutely. However, I will say it is complex. So the farmers we work with aspire to be in a Mom's Organics, many. The realities of that are quite challenging. So logistics being the number one challenge. The distributors take a very, very big cut from what they pay the farmer and what they sell. It's a legitimate cut in many cases. These are tough businesses where the margins are very low. So for a local farmer to get into that system, they're going to have to take a big pay cut, basically, for what they might have gotten through a farmer's market or through selling direct to someone like Spike. The way that our farms are going to be able to hopefully grow and get there are through efforts like Spike's efforts. It's incredibly important, I think. If we care about having farms, having small farms, if we care about having really nutrient-dense foods, I mean, it's a fact that many of the local foods are more nutrient-dense than some of the other products that you're going to get that have been trucked, sitting in trucks, and even their growing practices. I don't think a lot of people realize that hydroponic lettuce, which we have many hydroponic lettuce growers popping up everywhere, and it's great. We all have nice, fresh, wonderful lettuce, but it's not grown in soil, so it's actually missing quite a few nutrients. We haven't perfected, the act of God at this point. So I think it depends a lot on what your goal, your values are and what is important to you. I would say that getting rid of the chemicals should be number one value. I agree in terms of the what's happening in terms of our waterways and what we're seeing. I would also say that pastured meat is really important. If you are eating meat, I would be an advocate of eating meat because this is how we're going to improve our soil health. So we're learning so much more about soil health, and if we were to change our farming practices alone, we could deal with all the excess carbon in the atmosphere. That's a fact. Through agriculture, we could save the planet. Will that happen? Probably not. But you can see where in France they've actually made goals in terms of carbon drawdown through their farming practices. So they've actually set goals in terms of the percentage that they're going to increase carbon in the soil. And the best way to increase carbon in your soil is you get rid of the chemicals, you use cover crops, you use certain kinds of practices. Basically, you sort of go back to what we once did in farming, but bring in new technology and new science.
So. There's no question that those kind of regenerative practices are now, I think, getting the kind of the attention they deserve. Grass-based systems, I think, first and foremost. And grass-based is an important part of the proteins that you guys stock, right? Mm-hmm. The beef,
yep.
Pastured chicken, right?
Mm-hmm.
You want to talk? That does seem to be something you're able to find from around here.
As a matter of fact, our meat program's gotten really much stronger. That's a complicated industry, though, with the butchers and the, I guess, USDA. I don't have a full understanding of that industry, actually. I just know that I've seen our department really have a lot of options lately. And I agree with you that I think the key word that you said with local, it's complex. And when I say local is overrated, I still think it is overrated in the marketplace because if you take a survey of people, they will choose local over organic. So as I like to say, if you're farming chemically, I hope that you're farming outside of the Chesapeake watershed. Because local is not, I think those are mis. I think those are priorities that I don't agree with. I'd rather have organic from California than chemical farm food from here in Maryland.
Is there something that you would like to see that you still struggle with at Moms? Is there a department or a section that you think that you wish you could do better?
I could be here for an hour on that one. I love meat. Has been weak for a long time at our stores. Our produce is the best in the industry. No, I don't think there's other.
Well, how so? How is your produce the best in the industry?
Well, we get deliveries every day, and our handling. You know, it's really funny. If you guys go into, for example, Whole Foods, any grocery actually, but the ones I go into the most are Whole Foods, Trader Joe's, and even Sprouts has come on now. Did I say Wegmans? Much of their produce, I even hate to say this on the air, much of their produce is kept out of refrigeration all day long. And we're talking asparagus, strawberries, raspberries, zucchini, you name it, corn. They just put it out on tables. I don't think the consumer understands the damage that does to the quality of the product. The product gets old fast, especially some of these berries. Next time you go into any of those stores, maybe not Trader Joe's, but Wegmans and Whole Foods and Sprouts, just look at their produce section, and you'll see a ton of stuff that ought to be under refrigeration that isn't.
How about cheese?
Cheese is... no, cheese is good. We're a simple model, and I like it that way, and that's what I like about Costco and Trader Joe's. I'll personally just say I'm frustrated with our cheese operation because there are some stores where it's very good and some stores where it's excellent, and it has too much to do with who's the cheese cutter at that store, uh-huh. And the customer doesn't care who the cheese cutter is. and so I've walked into some stores that I've been really frustrated with because their Merrifield, for example, recently, their cheese looked terrible. And then I was up in our Cherry Hill, New Jersey store, and their cheese looked great, and it just had to do with the person working there. And that's frustrating as just an operator, because, again, the customer doesn't care at all whether your cheese person caught in sick or is off or on vacation.
I flip that question back to you, Tracy, which is, you're on the Eastern Shore of this historically great farming region, but are there things that you and your growers struggle with being there in that place?
Absolutely. There's many things. I would start with the sort of the political environment, the resistance for even the idea of what we were trying to do or what we are doing, which is working with the small farmers. So a lot of the traditional farmers, when they associated us with things like organic or trying to work with farmers to reduce their chemical loads, they immediately got very concerned that we were going to promote an ideology and policy that would make it harder for them to do what they're doing, which is spraying a lot of chemicals on a lot of corn, soy, and so on. So that actually was a battle. I mean, it's a war, you know, to a certain extent, because they fought us.
Why is it such a kind of all or nothing mindset with some folks?
I'm rereading Chesapeake, the book Chesapeake by Jane Michener, to try to understand that myself, because it seems to be rooted very much in the culture of the history. I think farming is really, really, really hard, and so these are hardscrabble people that have had to defend their livelihoods, and they've been sold a particular way of doing their business, uh-huh. and they believe in that way, and they feel like they're under attack. In Maryland, in particular, we have a very, very strong environmental community, and they have done amazing things to make sure that the Chesapeake Bay is protected, and so that raises the cost. Of even in the industrial side of things, it raises the cost of doing farming in Maryland, whereas you go across the line into Delaware and they don't have those same protections, or Pennsylvania. And so it's an uneven playing field, and they don't want that playing field to become even more uneven. And so a lot of people coming in with, you know, ideas about clean food, it made them nervous. I think we're winning them over. That's good news.
So I'm wondering if you would be supportive, Scott, of Tracy's efforts to displace conventional chemical-based agriculture with other forms of agriculture that may not be fully organic but are, I think, in every way measurably better than commodity corn and soy. How does that?
I mean, look, I'm all progress, not perfection. So a tablespoon of toxins that is an improvement, you know, if it's saved from entering the ecosystem. We can't, because one of our brand promises is that we only sell the highest quality 100% organic produce. Nothing is non-organic. It's all certified in our store. So we can't sell it if it has anything sprayed on it. But I support your efforts. And I bet you there's plenty of retailers who would take it. And, of course, maybe... I don't know much about IPM certification, which is integrated pest management, you know, or, you know, you go to farmers markets and you see, I like when they kind of tell you, like, it hasn't been sprayed, it's been sprayed once, you know, or as needed. Like, that's much better than these industrial guys who, I mean, I go down to the northern neck of Virginia, whole fields in June won't have one green blade of grass on them because they have just been nuked.
Right.
I mean, acres. By, I guess, Roundup.
Yeah.
And so, you know, yeah. So I support any improvement.
Is there a tension or a balance that you need to, that you feel you need to think about between carbon and moving a lot of this food around because if it has to come further away? Are there carbon impacts that you're concerned about when you're seeking organic?
Well, you know, I think organic is better carbon out of the gate because it takes quite a bit of energy to produce all those chemicals, and many of them are petroleum-based, for example. Now, there are food miles, and that is something that, again, is a factor, but it's, again, so complex. Nothing's ever black and white, and things are not always equal. I will get trucks down from Pennsylvania, and it's like a step truck, you know, it's small, it's one-third packed, and then you get these gargantuan tractor trailers out from the West Coast which are super efficient packed, floor to ceiling. I don't even know, for example, what the carbon, how that gets divvied up efficiency-wise per pound of stuff that's being trucked, you know, because, again, they're sending out such huge trucks. It's obviously more efficient to ship it that way. But, yes, food miles, I think, all things being equal, that's a asset or a pro for local.
So we have both acknowledged, I think, that we have a very well-informed marketplace here in this part of the country, and a lot of them are here in this room. And so this is the love to get some questions from our.
I have a question for Scott. Are you supportive of hydroponic being able to be certified organic?
I am, and that's very controversial in our industry. And again, I'm progress, not perfection. So I trust what you said. I'm in the dark a little bit about the nutritional value on hydroponics versus soil grown. Okay. Okay. Because I mean, I am also a backer of science, and so I know that nutrients can be added. But let's assume that they're lower. While hydroponics are being grown, and they're going to be grown, it's a business model, and I think NOSB, which is I forget what that stands for, National Organic Standards Board. Just ruled that hydroponics were available to be certified organic. So I just feel like hydroponics is a model. So if you want to grow heirloom tomatoes in New York or here or wherever in the wintertime, the only way to do that is in a greenhouse, and sometimes hydroponically, I guess.
Would you label it differently? As a consumer,
yeah.
I wish you would.
Well, I think we do. Okay. Like hydroponic, it is labeled, but it's also certified organic. So in a nutshell, it's being grown. I would like to give some hydroponic growers the opportunity to grow theirs certified organic. And that's progress, not perfection. It's like we sell like things that are bad for you, like chocolate and coffee and ice cream. And well, I know. And there used to be some purists in the industry when I started that wouldn't sell stuff that was even bad for you. So there is this thing where it's not as good as it could be. And almost every product somebody has a problem with. So we're always looking to improve whatever's there. It's like meat. Some people hate that we sell meat. They say we're hypocrites, it's bad for the environment, you're inhumane. But we say, look, it's better than the other stuff. So don't buy it if you don't want it. We want to give people the opportunity to buy better meat than what they're getting at Safeway or Giant.
Well, I had a question, but now I have two questions. So, building on your conversation just now, when you were saying that hydroponic farmers can add nutrients, are you talking about GMOs? That's my first question. And my second question is, I was reading an interview with the head of Kroger, who may very well have hubris, but she's not a white man, she's a woman of color, who said that one of the things that she really liked was that she could have local produce and organic produce. And she's very proud of that innovation in the Kroger's during her tenure. And how do you feel about how... Or do you feel that also Spike, because he's setting a trend to buy organic and local produce. I mean, how do you feel like you're upping the game of those big box stores?
Yeah, it's Whole Foods. I got to tell you, Whole Foods, they are irritating to me in their culture and their CEO and all that, but they deserve so much credit for changing the game. And so they are the ones who have really forced the hand of the people like Kroger. I think it was when, and you always have these big announcements. Like Walmart announced they were going to really do their own private label organics. They're going to drop the price. They were going to brand it Wild Oats. And I knew I was on the inside of that in many ways. And, you know, they put the plug on that eventually. But everybody was reading Whole Foods' obituary when that happened. Walmart was going to, like, decimate through pricing. You know, John Mackey's point was it's good for the industry when Stonyfield Farm organic yogurt is sold at Walmart, and I agree with that. And Whole Foods for decades now has kind of incubated our customer for us in the same way. We're more dedicated to organics. They carry so much non-organic produce and non-organic items. So I like it. I like that Kroger carries organics. Again, progress, not perfection. I hope, and it is everywhere now. I will end with this really quick. I remember, I think it was 2002, I almost fell out of my chair. I was watching TV, and I saw an ad for organic Rice Krispies. I mean, I couldn't believe it. It was on national TV. I thought organics had arrived after 15 years of being, you know, mocked and, you know, made fun of. You know, and so it's here to stay, and I like it that it's everywhere. Okay, can I say GMOs, please? You asked that. Sorry, really quick. I'm going to say something here that, again, I'm just going to say it. There's a lot of hysteria around GMOs. Again, I'm a science guy. We get, and I see it. I'm on the inside. I got my name on the bag. I get so many people who there's so much misinformation about GMOs. Most things are not GMO. Hardly anything is GMO because. I mean, I get accused of having GMO, like, lettuce or something. There's no GMO lettuce on this planet. It hasn't been done that way yet. So there's a lot of misunderstanding. And then the labeling is irritating. People will say non-GMO on an organic label. And actually, if you survey people, they prefer non-GMO to organic. Again, organic is non-GMO. I just want to make the point that around GMOs, there's a lot of... misinformation and overreaction to that, or misreaction, I should say.
I would say, you know, when it comes to Kroger or Walmart, they don't get. I think I used to blame them for a lot of what was going on in our food system. I don't really blame them for it, but they don't get any credit either. They are, as much as anything, maybe a mirror or maybe kind of a wind sock or something to where things are going. They're not going to put anything on their shelves because they think it's the right thing to do. They're going to put it on their shelves because it'll sell. They want velocity, and they want a lot of people coming through their aisles. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And so you can love them or hate them for that, but, you know, if she's putting organic and local up, it's just because she thinks it's going to sell.
That's so true. I mean, they're not very dedicated, and people can sniff that out. They're not authentic. And so to me, it's good that a person that's normally buying Fruit Loops is walking by the Nature's Path Fruityos. You know, every week until after maybe 50 times of doing that, let me try this box. But they're only doing it because they've been forced to do it. And if you walk into a lot of conventional grocery stores, they've got huge organic signs everywhere, and Wegmans does this a lot. And, I mean, that's primarily their message. It's because they know it helps their brand, but they're not selling much of that stuff or even offering it.
Okay. This is like the crux of the Origin series. We have an awesome supplier, or you're a seller. You've tapped into an incredible outlet, and we need Maryland to supply local food. It seems to me it's all about education and whether you buy because you want your own personality to be healthy or you want to buy because you want the environment to be healthy. Can your stores, they're small stores, I only know the one in Cocky.
Mm-hmm. So, thank you.
Is that the size that works?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, they're all the same about that? They're all like that size?
That's a mid-size store for us. The Hamden one is bigger.
Is it possible to adapt those stores so that you can carry more local produce at the time when it's being produced, as opposed to bringing it in from California?
Well, we carry a ton of local produce, actually, when it's in season. My only point was that I do feel like the consumer has, they don't prioritize it right. They prefer local to organics. I don't. I think that's not my priorities. We carry tons of local stuff. It's all organic. That's actually right. The double, what do they call it, the double winner or whatever, the gold standard when it's local and organic.
Right.
Sure is.
Right, so the question is, I mean, I like blueberries year-round. I realize I shouldn't be buying blueberries year-round. I should be only buying them when they're produced during the time of the year when they grow here, not in Peru. Mm-hmm. But are your farmers willing to take 10% of their land and grow something that's local as opposed to producing a generic crop, which I understand why, if you're a farmer, why you wouldn't want to do one thing that works all the time?
So the answer to that is absolutely yes. And they would need to be assured that they can sell the product. And where the breakdown is happening is in the logistics area. So if you have a farm that's, even if they're filling a small truck, it's not cost efficient to get that truck delivered to each one of his stores, which is your model. You require the farmer to come to each store. So we've talked to our farmers about supplying moms, and that's the issue. They literally can't physically do that. And the logistics don't support it because, again, the tractor trailers coming from California are fully packed, and they're using mechanized systems and other things that make the economies of scale work. We have willing farmers, but they don't have the science behind them, they don't have the technology, and we don't have the investment in the infrastructure here in Maryland yet. I think we will get it.
I would like to maybe challenge or push back a little bit there, which is, they could deliver to wholesalers really easily, either into Jessup or Four Seasons. And we actually do have a warehouse where, if it is a small farm, you don't know this, it's fairly new.
Okay, I was going to say.
We can bring a small farmers. I mean, my God, wouldn't it be great because I think bush blueberries might do fine out there.
Oh, absolutely.
If they could get going on something like that, mm-hmm. I don't know what the birds do. But anyway.
You net them.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, I mean, my God, if we could get a great local blueberry grower, and we have had great local blueberries, we'd buy. We send our truck to you.
I'm going to take you up on that. You heard it.
I'll do it.
Hey, I'm a shopper of Mom's Organic Market, and I have a six-year-old and twins that are four, and they've been shopping there since they were little. I just took a video of the twins dancing in your aisle, so I just want to say thank you. I'm also, the first part is just thank you. I love the coffee aspect of it. I know that's not local. I love that they help me to my car. So the customer service is to another level. And I also love the niche products. So Brooklyn hot dogs, I only could get up in Jersey at a certain store. And now you put it in Jessup's, I'm like, whoa, they have the Brooklyn hot dog. It's a snap with the hot dog. I'm a North Jersey guy. And then Woodbury Kitchen Pantry you also hold. So I just want to thank you for holding niche things that draws in consumers like me. My question is, though, is how do you... why or how do you source the Brooklyn hot dog or the Woodbury Pantry? Because I don't see it anywhere, and I'm glad you're disrupting the industry and you're allowing me to spend my money on that.
Yeah. One of our brand promises is incredible selection. We have four brand promises, and I told you the other one or another one was the only organic, highest quality organic produce. So the incredible selection is, it's just that. I mean, you are almost a walking advertisement for our brand promise. Because even the carrying of the bags is a policy. And that's part of our remarkable customer service brand promise. So anyway, I don't do a lot of sourcing. I have a team, a large team who does that, and they're brilliant. I do some sourcing, and I work on merchandising. But that's incredible selection. Incredible selection, we have the highest ingredient standards in the industry. So we think that's incredible about our selection. And then we also have these really unique products and high-quality products that you can't find. And so that kind of creates that treasure hunt I was talking about, where you go in and you're like, holy cow, these hot dogs are great. Spike's products are the same thing. You get in there and you buy his tomato paste or jellies or something, and you're like, wow, I can only get this here at Mom's. And that's very important to our customers. Thanks for sharing that.
Hi. I was wondering if you think it's possible for some of the big production farmers on the Eastern Shore to carve out a small portion of their land or their production to grow some of the organic and local products so that they can balance the cost and the economic return? Because, like you were saying, it's so hard to move the products and to guarantee a farmer who's only doing locally sourced products enough income to make it worthwhile. But if they were coupled somehow, it seems that you could get what the farmer needs and also source the local and organic component of it.
So absolutely. I mean, there's plenty of land to do that. And so it's definitely an end-to-end. You know, you can do the industrial farming and we can be doing the local food or the specialty crop farming. The challenge, I'm going to say again, is the logistics and getting enough critical mass so that the farms are either close enough together. So when you're running a truck, you're doing it with efficiency, and then you're aggregating that product in some warehouse somewhere, and then you can get it delivered where it needs to go. You mentioned the distributors. The distributors are coming to the shore and they're picking up, but again, the price point is very, very low, so it's a challenge. So we don't have all the things lined up yet for that actually to happen. What we're concentrating on now is educating the farms about the opportunities, getting them to put in blueberries, for example, and also getting them food safety certified, which is another very important thing. They need to be food safety certified. That's something that happens by product. And pretty much, I think it's 17% of our farms nationwide are food safety certified. So a lot of our food that's being sold into the marketplace is not actually food safety certified. But many buyers, I'm imagining you are one, require some sort of GAP certification, I would think. Am I right about that? Yeah. Certainly true of pretty much everyone we've ever talked to. So there's a lot of things that have to come together.
Do you have a question, Megan? Or a comment?
Yeah. Hang on.
So I want to thank you for having this conversation. I sort of sit in between you and you. I sell on your shelves, and I sometimes buy from you. Mm-hmm. And I would like to know in this conversation, we're all talking about organic food, local food, the consumer. Do you really think that what sits on our shelves reflects the true cost of food, given that you can buy organic food, certified organic food, for pennies, it seems like, whereas in order for us to make a living, for us to pay my employees, I have to sell fermented foods at a price that a lot of people find to be very expensive, but we find to be actually be the true cost of that food. And actually, we probably should charge a little bit more. I'd just like to hear a little bit about how you feel that fits into the consumerist marketplace these days.
Why don't you just identify your product for people?
Sure. So my name is Megan, and my husband and I, along with our team, make fermented foods, and we're called Hex Ferments.
Oh, is that say that again?
Hex Ferments.
We touched on this earlier. I mean, we externalize the costs of our food production. So there's been studies. Actually, this is a great book. It's on the list, The Value of Nothing. This is a 2012 book or something, but so the numbers are outdated. But it was estimated that the true cost of a McDonald's hamburger should be $200 versus, you know, whatever it is, $2. So we're externalizing those costs through carbon in our atmosphere, through our health costs. 40% of our diseases are food-related diseases, and this is something that is coming down like a freight train at us as a nation, because it's going to completely take over our economy if we don't do something about it. So we're upside down. We're upside down on this issue.
I've heard of your products. It just came up about a week ago. I can't remember the context. Oh, no, I think Lisa DeLima said, well, we need to carry the Hex Foods of the world. I will say that, you know, I go to a farmer's market every week, and I don't buy much there because a lot of it is not, I mean, if it's great, okay, I will, but a lot of it's overpriced in my opinion. But I like farmer's markets because they give startups an opportunity to cut me out and to cut out the distributor. So it's kind of like me buying my sister's Malibu station wagon and going out of my mother's garage to start my company. And that was how I could compete with the big guys. So I like these ways that you guys can sell your product at full margin. But there comes a point, I believe, that, for example, there was a woman who was selling us salad dressings. And I love their salad dressings. And she kept on saying, hey, can I get my salad dressings? And finally, I looked at the numbers. I think she was charging $12 for 12 ounces. And it wasn't selling. You know what I mean? So it's really not us who decides. It's the consumer. And you know, it's a war, especially for manufacturers. And I mean, to you guys, it's a lot about your brand. But it's a war. That's what commerce is. That's what the free market really is. And we're at war with, as Spike said, other grocers. And so we have to work so hard to keep our costs down and to, you know, I just invested in a clean energy company, and I said, I don't like the way this company is run because I wasn't used to a company being run with money because I thought they were too kind of soft and spending it too freely and not bootstrapping enough. So anyway, that's what I'll say from an entrepreneurial point of view, is you guys are in the fight for your life, and it's up for the – it's not between me. I mean, we just mark it all up the same. It's your consumer who's going to tell you whether you have a marketplace at the right price.
Well, that's what I appreciate about Moms, is that I do feel the pricing in there is reflective of the cost. Mm-hmm. But for, I feel like for the farmer that's trying to compete in a marketplace where they're not certified organic, mm-hmm. but say they do have organic practices, which our business was founded on. We supported local growers, and now a lot of those local growers that we work with are certified organic. Mm-hmm. And we are now certified organic, mm-hmm. which was a pain in the butt, and it is legitimate. I can testify to that. But from the farmer's perspective, you know, I work with a lot of farmers who I ask, okay, well, what do you want for your cost per pound for carrots? And they have no clue. Mm-hmm. And I find that to be a little scary from the fact that do they not know the costs and the inputs that are going into making that carrot? And are they trying to compete with, say, agriculture from California, where it is a lot cheaper. Mm-hmm. So I just think from someone that buys literally tons of produce every single year, I find that every year we're sitting down with farmers and we're having these conversations like, well, what do you need to make? And yeah. I can try to match that to then pass that on to my ferments and then on to my consumer.
Yeah. It's arbitrary, the pricing. Yeah. It's a commodity.
It goes really on. Hard.
Yeah. Yeah.
Getting back to the economics part of this, what fraction of the population do you think will be able to afford what you sell, so or what you grow? So, for example, I would imagine that the majority of individuals in this country are having a difficult time, or many people are having a difficult time affording their food. Mm-hmm. So the $2 McDonald's hamburger, it's a great source of starch and carbohydrates and fats and protein for somebody who's not making a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So how do we get to the point where more people, other than a very esoteric group of individuals with a certain income, can move over to this kind of food?
I mean, well, this... I mean, look, this is a... class problem of economics, like you said. And so it's not that the food is unaffordable, it's that poverty exists for a million reasons, whether it's, you know, it's generational. As a matter of fact, I would never open in a poor part of town because there's no demand there, because poor people don't even want organic food. They don't see the value in it, generally. And this is a cultural thing. That's why you have, there's a lot of sodas, a lot of McDonald's. I don't think it's, And I've seen people take organic concepts into poorer parts of town, and they just have to close up shop. So it's not, and so I know you're asking about the price. I'm saying yes, you're right in that people can't afford. Organics is more expensive. Part of that is the unfair subsidies that the government gives.
Do you know the economics of the people who buy in Mons? Do you have any? You probably don't have that information.
I have a gut feel. Cause
but I mean, I want. It's, I don't think it's just people who are living below the poverty line. I think it's probably a lot of people who are in the middle class.
That can't afford organics?
Yeah.
No, I don't think that's accurate. The reason why I don't think that's accurate is because we have some stores in middle class areas. And then we have some stores in upscale areas. It's about priorities for them. During the recession, the Great Recession, we never had a negative month of comps year over year. Our customers are so dedicated to organics that they will give up a vacation. They will stop eating out. It's kind of like asking someone to go to a discount, lower quality doctor. People are not going to do that. So our customers will go out of their way, the middle class will go out of their way to buy organic foods because it's their worldview.
I would just say people, in my opinion, we need to eat differently. So yeah, maybe it's more expensive if you're still consuming the same amount of meat. But if you start to reduce your meat intake and eat more vegetables, you can make some adjustments. But I would also argue that we should be paying more for our food, that's the right thing to do. If you look at the sort of globally, we still have very inexpensive food here as compared to a percentage of our income than anywhere else in the world. So we buy a lot of things, cheap things. Maybe, you know, cutting back on some of that kind of consumerism and paying more attention to what you're putting in your body is a higher, should be a higher priority. The poverty issue's real. I'm not arguing, but again, the country, we're upside down.
I mean, why is Coke so much cheaper than like Honest Tea or any kind of natural drink? It's because of that high fructose corn syrup,
sure,
which is highly subsidized and mass produced. And by the way, the privatized cost of that is this obesity epidemic, and so healthcare costs go up. I mean, you're what ought to be happening is they ought to be subsidizing the hell out of organics or cleaner food, and not giving them a penny because they are damaging the environment and damaging people's health. They're putting people in morgues.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You're here. Spike asked earlier about there's a lot of levers that we're trying to pull here to have a better environment and better outcomes and better health and all that. But Spike isolated in one question earlier about the carbon impact of food. And I'm wondering how many of like your customers or your distributors do you think appreciate that, and you just touched on this a moment ago, that it isn't so much that the 10% or 20% or 50% more carbon that's embodied in a vegetable that's shipped across the country versus a local vegetable. The big carbon impact is eating vegetables instead of meat.
Yeah.
And I am a carnivore. I mean, I eat meat. I'm not saying, but the big divide is not local produce versus California mm-hmm. produce. Mm-hmm. It's the percentage of our diet that mm-hmm. we devote to feeding with meat. Because then you're talking about factors of 10 at a minimum to 20 to 30 more carbon impact versus a plant-based diet. So do people understand that?
I think it depends. Well, I would just say it depends on how the meat was raised. I generally agree with what you say, but I do think it does depend somewhat. Pastured meat is essential for soil health.
For crop-fed meat.
And soil health is critical for carbon drawdown. So it's a systems, and it's, I think sometimes we get obsessed with pieces of the system, and we want to like think that our carbon footprint is lower or this. I think what we have to really look at here is full-on behavioral changes that are just more in alignment with the values that you're looking, you know, to bring to the world.
I mean, you're I believe that you're correct in that fact. What do they call it, CAFO? What does that stand for again?
Confined Animal Feeding Operation.
Yeah, that stuff is just, you know, terrible. You know. Yeah. By the way, another huge carbon draw is refrigeration of food. I mean, that just pulls so much energy. But yeah, the CAFO meat is if people switch to fruits and vegetables and grains, it'd be a different ballgame, and not just with the environment, but for health. I eat meat, by the way, but I rationalize it. I always take the stuff going past date. It was already gonna, you know.
One more. We have time for one more.
Hi. Thank you both. So thank you all for sharing, and it's been really educational. Scott, I wanted to ask you two questions. One, have you seen, and this kind of piggybacks off of the previous question, have you seen a rise in vegan options in your locations? And my second question was, do you have a particular things that you look for as far as real estate is concerned when you are looking to open new stores?
Yeah, veganism is on the rise. It always has been. So there's always, it's a big deal. However, meat sales are on the rise. I think organic meats in the industry, it's a category that's growing. Store location, it's, you know, there's a reason why retailers close stores, even the best retailers, because there is no exact science to it. It's largely a gut feel for me. I was telling Dana that this Hamden store I didn't even want. I got convinced, talked into it, it's our best store. So, you know, I feel like I look for major highways, easy to get to, a Google map. I used to drive around and look for jumbo, you know, playgrounds and, you know, kids, sign of kids. Yeah, we just look for density. And we can go. We have a store, I think two stores in PG County. And we've had the one store in there since 2000, the other one since 2006 or 7, or I'm sorry, 8. And Whole Foods just got there, like this year. I don't even think Trader Joe's is in PG County yet. So anyway, we can go to places like Waldorf. Waldorf, Maryland is one of our best stores ever. It's incredible. Even I grew up in PG County, and we always refer that to the armpit of PG County. You know, and
we can cut that out.
Yeah. And it's one of our most fantastic stores. So anyway, long story short, it's a crapshoot. No matter what, we do our best.
Well, the conversation can and will continue over supper. We've got a great supper. It was somehow, I'm not sure if it was inspired by local supermarket food, but we did some pastas, and we've got a meat pasta, a vegetable pasta, some really great salads. I want to thank Tracy and Scott for being here. Tremendous conversation. One of the best I think we've ever had. We got into some stuff, and I love it.
Thanks again for joining us tonight for our conversation at Artifact Coffee. With special thanks to Dana Slater for producing the program, Hannah Reagan for her masterful coordination, and particular thanks to Donnie Carlo for recording this evening's conversation. We're grateful to be partnering with Heritage Radio in Brooklyn, New York. Thank you to them for creating a home for the Origin Speaker Series.